Session number 30020, reel 2.
Well, very pleasant. We've got on fine. And of course, there was no getting away from the fact that if you had someone who could speak German, you could do so much better because you could communicate so well. I mean, there were two interesting things happened where the communication was so useful. Was my brother was, this was well after the war, we were in Germany, and my brother, I told you, I think was killed at the end of the war, and he was buried in a War Graves Commission cemetery at a place called Becklingham, and we were in that part of the country, so we thought we'd go along and see if we could find the grave in the cemetery. I'd already been in touch with the War Graves Commission and they'd given me all the details about him. Well, we were trying to find it and weren't getting very far when we saw some soldiers working in fatigues by the side of the road. So I thought, right, well, I'll go and ask them, they're bound to know. As I told you, my German wasn't all that good. And I was asking them, tell me where the cemetery was. I wasn't getting very far, and I couldn't understand a word they were saying. And Erica, my wife, looked out of the window and she said, well, don't be silly. They aren't German, they're Scottish. So she got out and took over, and we soon found out where to go. She could understand Scottish better than I could. But that, on the other hand, was also useful when we were in Berlin. And rather than go on a coach trip around East Berlin, this was before the wall came down, we thought we'd walk in. So we walked into Checkpoint Charlie, went to the East German gate, got visas for the day, and literally spent the day in East Berlin. My wife can remember some of this because we went down to some place where they had pleasure boats sailing along the River Spray. So we did a tour on this. It took up the afternoon. Very pleasant. We came back, caught the train into the middle of Berlin, and then we walked to Checkpoint Charlie to come home. When we got there, the madam in charge, she was having a hell of a row with someone who was trying to get in. We never knew quite what it was all about, but she wasn't in a very happy state of mind. Kept us waiting out of a long time. There were one or two other English people coming through too. She sort of thumped the passports down on the desk in front of us when we went. And by God, it was amazing how nice it was to get back out of the East into the West again. But we wouldn't have done that if she hadn't been able to speak. If we were there not being able to speak German, she could speak German, and the whole thing was interesting. And that was about all that ever happened, except we used to go to Austria or Switzerland or somewhere like that because it was an advantage. We used to walk an awful lot. And that's what we did on holidays, walk.
You mentioned that there was anticipation of the war as the 30s progressed.
Yes.
Was there any sense as to what sort of war it would be?
No. Well, I don't think it was. I don't think, quite honestly, when June 1940 came along and Germany went through Holland and Belgium into France, I don't think anybody realised that it would be just like that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I would have thought that at that time, Germany probably had the finest army the world had ever seen, I should think. It was unstoppable. It really was. I mean, he combined, if you like, military power on the ground with air power. I mean, the whole thing was fantastic, really. And, well, let's be fair, Poland couldn't stand up to it initially. Russia couldn't stand up to it. It wasn't until they wore themselves up a bit like Napoleon marching on Moscow that the tide turned Stalingrad. and the tide turned again here at the same time at El Alamein. But it took a long time for the tide to turn, and in those initial years, Germany was unstoppable. But they'd done all this. Well, I suppose we were rearming, but we never rearmed, I don't think, quite to the same degree, except that we did have the Spitfire and the Hurricane. And even in 1940, we still won the Battle of Britain. If we hadn't won the Battle of Britain, perhaps we might have invaded, I don't know. But no one, I never remember feeling pessimistic. It never occurred to me that we weren't going to win the war. I don't think anyone was sort of going around in fear, except in the East End of London. I mean, what, 60,000 people were killed, I suppose, in the Blitz. And yet, when you look at the city of London, St. Paul's was barely damaged. I think there might have been a bit of superficial damage. Westminster Abbey wasn't damaged. I believe there was one of the city churches which was knocked down. I forgot which one it was. But by and large, the city churches weren't damaged. We had a 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne. And the cathedral wasn't damaged. The only cathedral I was in, well, two. One was Coventry Cathedral, which was damaged, and the other was Dresden, which is still a bone of contention today, which was also damaged. But for some reason or other, cathedrals didn't seem to get damaged during the war. An act of God, I suppose. City, a lot of the city was in a mess, but not the cathedrals. When I went back after the war, there's whole areas which were flat. And bit by bit, of course, it all got rebuilt. And that's what happened.
Do you remember what your reaction to the declaration of war was?
Well, A, you might say, sometime we were anticipating it. Maybe we didn't quite know how, but we did. But we did have treaty obligations with Poland. And when the Germans marched into Poland, we honoured them. We gave him an ultimatum that he should withdraw by 11 o'clock on the 3rd of September, was it? And we had this announcement by Neville Chamberlain over the phone saying that he'd had no reply to his ultimatum and that we were now in a state of war with Germany. Well, I don't know, we might have had more reason to be upset or worried about this. I don't know about upset, but that's all the wrong word, because I say Erich was German. But otherwise, after that, we had this phony war period, everybody carried on, until Germany had their blitzkrieg on Europe. Unstoppable. And that's what happened. Desultory bombing, I suppose. That sort of thing, either way. I don't know. I just feel that I don't know quite what I thought, really. As I say, we were rearming. But don't forget, in 1930, 29, 31, was the years of the Great Depression. And this, of course, hit Germany much harder than it would anyone else, because they'd already suffered reparations under the Versailles Treaty. In the middle of the 1920s, their currency, well, virtually lost all its value. They weren't in a happy position by 1929 to 31. And I suppose when Hitler came to power in 1933, to them, he was a godsend. There's no doubt about it. As I say, we were there in 34, and you could sort of feel it. But then things went wrong from thereafter. And you could see it all going wrong, particularly with the Jews, I suppose. But But I don't know. Sorry, I've forgotten what you asked me now.
How did your parents respond to you and your brothers being called up?
My father never quite certain what he did. He was in the army towards the end of the war, but I don't think he was ever in the trenches or anything. There were three boys, so we were all in the army. I don't know. I would have thought my father, he would have accepted this because that's how we'd been brought up. We'd gone to a school which had an OTC, and this is what you did, and this was your duty, you might say. I just don't know. The only thing was that they lived in London. We at that time were living in Berkhamsted, my wife and I, which is 30 miles away. So they weren't in a position probably to help as much as they might, although they certainly did, because they looked after Penn when she was born, and Erica came and visited me. So they were there all the time, and fortunately, of course, they thought the world of my wife. They had three boys, and my mother was delighted to have a daughter. And that's all there was to that. No, I do not know, because I doubt whether they would have said or you would have felt anything. But I suppose, like everybody else, they must have felt the same, they must have been worried. But also, all these families we knew, all of them probably lost someone during the course of the war. In fact, right, you asked me, my brother was killed in April 1945. That's late in the war, as you can imagine, in Germany. My youngest daughter was born in June 1945. I remember this quite well. I remember my father getting her £100 to spend on something when my daughter was born, the youngest daughter. Not long after that, he died. Whether it was the shock of my son being killed, I do not know. I'm sorry, my brother being killed, I do not know. Well, I suppose we might have had this with my son. If he'd been in the army a little bit later, he would have been in the Falklands War. Now, it would have made you wonder what it was like if you've got sons in the army during the Falklands War. But he wasn't. He'd retired just before that. Again, he was on a reserve. He might have been called up, but he wasn't. So we would have probably felt the same. I don't know.
And what about your wife?
I'm sorry?
What about your wife?
My wife? Sorry.
When you were called up?
Well, when I was called up, she was left with Penelope, my daughter, who's over there, who might have been here today if she's going away. She's as bright as anything. I don't really know. I mean, she just had to be there and look after the baby. And that was that. I think whether my mother came up, I feel she probably did and helped. Towards the end of the war, we used to have a nurse who came to help. But at that time, she only had my mother, and who was 30 miles away, and, as I say, our Dutch next-door neighbour, who was frightfully kind. Well, the neighbours were kind. There was only one person I told you about who shouted at her, but that didn't last very long, I don't think. Yes. One doesn't know, does one, what she must have felt. But she was lucky in one sense, in that I had a home posting. Whether they did that because I was married, I do not know, would never know. But in that sense, she was lucky. The only time I really went abroad was when I went over to France to take those pictures and write the report on the German guns over at the other side. Otherwise, I suppose you might say we were the same as anybody else whose husbands were in the army or the services abroad and whose wives were naturally left at home. Yeah. Well, that's what happened.
Was she involved in war work?
I'm sorry?
Was she involved in war work at all?
No, she didn't. She didn't. I think because she has children, she didn't do any war work, whereas other friends we had did. They were involved in war and might have been making parachutes and that sort of thing, you know. But no, she wasn't involved in war work.
You'd mentioned earlier that you were deferred for 2 months, was it?
I'm sorry?
Was it 2 months that your call-up was deferred for?
We were deferred from Feb, when Penn was born. She was born on the 10th of Feb. At that time, I got that deferment until April, when I was then sent down to Plymouth, where I was lucky, really, because it was static. I suppose it was non-competent. I don't know that one thought of that particularly, but if you were sent there, well, that's where you went and that's what you did. But as it happened, it was very lucky for us. We were very lucky. I mean, if you want to be separated for 6 years, which is what happened, it was quite a good way of being separated. I mean, if it was my younger brother, we never knew what on earth had happened to him. He was out in the Middle East and we never knew where he was or what was going on. Well, for that matter, I didn't know where my elder brother was, nor did my parents. It wasn't until I started doing investigations after the war that we found out what he'd been doing. But, you know, tracing the history. So it was quite... Well, I suppose it was interesting, but when I look back, I sometimes wonder, what the hell did we do for 6 years, you know? How did 6 years go by when we didn't really do anything particularly, except we were there, or I was, in different parts of the country, doing slightly different jobs, and yet it didn't amount to very much when you come to think of it. On the other hand, I suppose someone had to do it, and that was that. But one was lucky to do it under one's circumstances, particularly mine.
Could you explain a bit more about what your time at Plymouth involved?
When I first went to Plymouth, I went into an other ranks training unit. This was for basic military training. If you were an officer cadet, you wore a white band round your hat. The recruiting sergeants, when you first went there, were only too pleased to have someone who was officer cadet because they knew that they would know most of the work, initial work drill and that sort of thing, which is what happened. They were awfully nice people, these sergeants, and so we had 2 months of basic military training, which we'd already done, if you like, because we'd done it at school, and I did it subsequently with the London University OTC. When we finished that, we, who were officer cadets, were sent to an OCTU, an officer cadet training unit, where we then were trained to be officers. That was about 2 months, I think. And the officer commanding that, he was Major Richards at the time, he was a martinet, he was extremely good in my opinion, and he was the person who, as Colonel Richards, commanded the 15-inch guns at Dover subsequently, where I finished off. What did we do? Well, when you were commissioned, you were sent to different units. For some reason or other, I was sent back to the unit I just left in command of a squad of new intakes. So I'd only been in the army 4 months. I was then training people. Literally, that's what happened. And I was there for some little while until I think I told you that there was the opportunity of going on a war gunnery course, which was, well, I suppose it was, how do I put it? The sort of the higher levels of gunnery, you know, more advanced gunnery principles, that sort of thing. So I thought I would do that, which is what I did do, and we passed out there. And then we got sent to different regions to see what was going on in all the batteries situated there. Because most of the towns, you see, the coastal towns, had coast artillery defence. And even other parts of the country. But this had been going on for a long time. I mean, well, okay, it had been going along from the time the Normans came, I suppose. You had Henry VIII, been defending, building castles down in Falmouth. The citadel where we were at Plymouth was built in Charles II's reign. The Martello Towers were built during the Napoleonic Wars. They weren't ever used. None of these things were used. The only time I say anything was ever used was at Hartlepool's. I've still got my exercise book detailing everything I did on my war gunnery course, including a description of the action at Hartlepool's and also the battles of Coronel and Falkland Islands in the First World War in 1914. They were all in 1914. Well, that was the year of my birth, but I don't think there was any relevance there. But I've still got that book. I can show it to you if you wish to see it. I suppose that's an archive.
How arduous did you find the basic training and your officer training?
I didn't find any of that arduous at all. I might add that when I was at school, I was captain of athletics. I ran after I left school up to the outbreak of war. I was competitive. I was fit. The only thing I do remember was we used to do PT. I could run faster than anyone else in the regiment, I know that much. But when we had gym exercises, I always found pulling up on a bar rather more difficult. I never really done that. You didn't have to do that if you were running. But I do remember finding that a bit difficult. At least not as good as some of the others. But no, I was perfectly fit. I don't had any trouble whatsoever with fitness. Well, let's be fair, we didn't have to be fit. In fact, I know on one occasion, the garrison at Plymouth, yeah, the garrison, that's the whole of the garrison with all the troops, everybody were there. They had a cross-country race around the foothills of Dartmoor. Well, this was just up my street, and I ran in that, and I won it quite easily. But the officer commanding the garrison, I don't think he was frightfully pleased that someone who was in a static unit, like Coast Artillery, won a race against all his combative troops. In the area. Yes, no, I was never lacked for fitness at all.
What about the discipline?
Sorry?
What about the discipline?
Discipline? I suppose the discipline was normal army discipline, and I never remember it causing any problems at all. No. I think towards the end of the war I did sit on one court martial because someone went absent without leave, but that's about the only thing I remember. No. I think discipline was pretty good, really.
When did the war gunner course finish?
I think the war gunnery course was about 4 months. I'll show you the book I've got if you'd like to see it. I didn't bring it out, but it's in the cupboard there. And you can see roughly what it entailed. And it's all finished now. It's all out of date. You don't have it any longer. You don't have guns around the coast. I mean, you've got guided missiles and things, haven't you? The whole nature of war has changed. This is the end of an era, really, it was. And I'll tell you, this was so, when you come to think of it, we lost Singapore. I had friends who were captured in Singapore, and you never knew what on earth had happened to them. But the fact of the matter is, I think I'm right in saying it was the Prince of Wales and the Repulse who were there off Singapore, both sunk by air power because they had no aerial protection. And a battleship was useless against air power. And I think that Hitler rather had the Bismarck, the Tirpitz, Scharnhorst, and Eisenhower, all those wonderful battleships which he built, contrary to provisions of all, any treaty which they signed up, he didn't bother about them. They were all destroyed by, in effect, air power. Even the Bismarck was destroyed by air power, if only because a torpedo from a Swordfish aeroplane, which you people used to laugh at, destroyed its steering gear. But in the end, they didn't do anything. The Tirpitz never did anything. The Scharnhorst and the Eisenhower, who came through the channel, in the end, they didn't do anything. One was sunk at sea. The other, I think, was destroyed in dock. The warship, I suppose they did quite well in the Middle East against the Japanese, the Americans. But by and large, I think in the European theatre, they'd had their day. And that was that, I suppose. Things have changed, you know. When I look at things now, I thought, well, I was born in 1914. At that time, the British Empire was at its apogee. We fought two world wars, I think, with great courage and fortitude and sacrifice, great sacrifice. Since when, we've steadily lost our industrial base, slowly going. A lot of it's now still being sold overseas. We've lost our sovereignty, and now what are we? Subservient to Europe. My lifetime, everything's gone. But I suppose everybody's happy, and that's the main thing. But it has. It's all gone and going. And yet, when you come to think of it, about the best thing in this country, as I see it, are the armed services still. Because I still think they're brilliant. And they always have been. I've just finished reading Blenheim by Charles Spencer. I think it's an excellently researched and written book. And the thing really, when you read that book, one of the things which won that battle was discipline. And normally we've had discipline in the services. Brilliance at times. Anyway, here we are, I'm still alive. So, happy here.